Good morning. Hate to interrupt all these fantastic conversations, but I know we want to continue moving through the day. My name is Kyle Wade, and I am the CEO and president of the Atlanta Community Food Bank. The Atlanta Community Food Bank is one of the largest hunger relief organizations in the Southeast. We support a network of 600 partner organizations across 29 counties in North Georgia. And working with those partners, some of whom I think are here today, we connect some 750,000 people every year to more than 60 million pounds of food, which is about 50 million meals. That's what we did last year, and we know that we serve about half of the food insecure people in the state of Georgia. And because of that, we know a lot about the people, the clients we serve, the folks who receive our food. We know that those clients, more than 70% of them, are constantly facing difficult trade-offs and choices in their lives, choosing regularly between paying for food and paying for transportation or paying for utilities or paying for their medical bills. And recognizing the cost of having to make those choices, that is why we are so committed and proud to sponsoring and helping make possible the following discussion. When essential benefits like SNAP or school meals or childcare or transportation and work supports are available to families, when those families can access those benefits, they can use their other resources, their other income, to pay for food and basic needs. And that really helps them focus on building economic stability in their lives, along with other forms of stability around health and education, and really build the lives that they imagine. The next panel is going to focus on strategies to increase economic mobility and stability for Georgia families. I think the team has done a fantastic job assembling just a terrific Georgia-grown panel of experts and thought leaders. And so please join me in welcoming the following panelists. And I'm just going to read their names and organizations. Their biographies are in your program on pages 7 and 8. So please welcome Ray Bishop of Goodwill of North Georgia, DeShonda Hughes of the Atlanta Women's Foundation, Barbara Duffy, from North Fulton Community Charities, and Melissa Johnson from the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute. And then the discussion will be moderated by Georgia Budget and Policy Institute's Tim Sweeney. So with that, I'll turn it over to Tim.
Thank you. And I'm just going to do this from right here. Thank you to the Community Food Bank for their support and to make this happen. I wanted to use this panel to build off the conversation we just had about boosting incomes for families, and kind of take the next step that economic security is about more than just that, or that there are more tools to boost family economic security than just increasing their wages and a state EITC, both of which would help greatly. Food insecurity, as was just mentioned, is certainly important. But beyond that, even just if having a job comes with some other hurdles. If you're a single parent, and we saw earlier that there's growth in single parents in Georgia, going to work means you have to find some place for your kid to be during the day to get educated and to thrive. Getting a better job sometimes requires some more skills, some more education, some more training. Sometimes being able to continue to work requires that you have some time off to go get health care. But if you're uninsured, how do you do that? So I asked all these these folks to join us, and I think that connection of all these issues is kind of what connects this panel. It seems like it's a handful of different issues, but really it's all connected around the same thing of how are we boosting the resources that families have, not just incomes, but access to health care, high-quality child care, the types of education and training opportunities that help them get better jobs. And so I'm going to go down the line here and just let each of these individuals talk a little bit about the work that they're doing on this front and kind of how that feeds in. And I'm going to start with Melissa, who does a lot of work on this front at our office and that really kind of touches a few of these policy issues.
So I'm the Economic Security Policy Analyst at GBPI, and as I was just saying to Barbara, our whole mission, as Taifa said and Wes said, is really related to economic security. So I specifically focus on adult education and training, food access and hunger issues, and of course, child care. And I'll just piggyback a little bit off of what Tim was saying. To have and maintain a job that pays a living wage in Georgia, that's the broader vision, that's what we all want. You have to be qualified for that job, and that's where education and training comes in. You have to have a place that you feel comfortable putting your kids, and over a third of Georgia's workforce are parents. So the need for high quality childcare is pretty prevalent. And you need to be healthy enough to get to work. And a subset, a very important subset of that healthcare, just not being able to, not just being able to go to a doctor when you're sick, but food access is a part of health. And we talked about that a little bit earlier. So I look at food access and hunger issues. So those are some of the challenges facing families. And what we do at GBPI is kind of outline the opportunities for Georgia to address some of those challenges through investing in things like child care. And we did a report with our partner up here, Atlanta Women's Foundation, that we'll talk about in a little bit. But child care specifically helps parents not only to get to work, but to be better workers. And we'll be producing a report just in the coming weeks about programs that we traditionally think of as safety net programs, so temporary assistance for needy families. There's a SNAP, or food stamp, employment and training program. These are federal programs that we can be leveraging so that we can provide the education and training so that people can qualify for higher paying jobs and meet their basic needs. So I'll turn it over to the rest of the panel.
And before we turn it over to Ray real fast, the point really of these next three panelists is to show, to really highlight a couple of the partners that we've been working with and to show some of the work that's being done on the ground and then get into a conversation about how policy and how we can kind of build on some of that work. And so obviously what Goodwill of North Georgia does and what Ray does is you know firmly rooted in this ability to help people move their way up and give them some more skills. And so we're really excited that says he's here to talk about what they're doing, but then also how we can maybe help them do it for more folks.
Well, thank you. Part of what some of you may be asking is why Goodwill Industries is on the panel, right? So part of our mission has always been jobs, training for jobs, and job placement services. And in Georgia, we are the largest private provider of those services. You didn't know that, did you? So last year, in 2014, the four Goodwills that are based in Georgia placed almost 28,000 people into jobs. That's a significant number. I work for Goodwill Industries of North Georgia, and this year our target is to put 20,000 people to work. We're halfway through our fiscal year, we're on target to do that. Also, we're a large employer. We're a large employer targeting to people who have low skills. So the Goodwills of Georgia employ more than 4,500 people across the state. It makes us one of the largest private sector employers as well. So we're an employer, we're in the job training and placement program, and we network with a lot of other partners. And what we see is a very difficult environment some of which has been touched on before, but also it wraps around all these other services. It is childcare. You cannot get a stable job and stay there unless you've addressed the childcare issues or healthcare issues or transportation. All those things are all linked together, and we spend a lot of time with our staff not only working on finding the jobs that are in the community and connecting the person to that job, but also figuring out how to figure out all those other services as well. In addition to that, we work a lot on soft skills. So it's appreciating the culture of the organization that you go to work for, having the appropriate work behaviors. We spend a lot of our time and energy directing attention to developing the soft skills. We have hard skills training programs, and we partner now primarily with the Technical College System of Georgia. And we can talk a little bit more about that later, but there's a very effective partnership in helping people move from low-skill, low-wage jobs into mid-skill, mid-income jobs. And I have some of the same concerns that you saw earlier presentations that Mike did about the future of those types of jobs and how they're evolving. And so we can talk a little bit more about that later. Thank you.
Next, turn it over to DeShonda, and the Women's Foundation is a great partner with a report that Melissa worked on the importance of childcare assistance. And so I won't go into it. I'll just let you talk about your work in this area and the findings and kind of why y'all are doing this.
Thank you. I'm DeShonda Hughes. I'm the mission director of the Atlanta Women's Foundation. And what's that? What's the mission director? It's everything. At the Women's Foundation. It is our mission to be a catalyst for change in the lives of women and girls and to eliminate generational cycle of poverty. Since 1986, we have invested over $13 million in over 250 nonprofit organizations that are working in that area. We have funded organizations that work in the area of homelessness, violence against women, economic justice, pregnancy prevention, childhood obesity. Childhood sexual exploitation. I actually used to call it firefighting. That's what it felt like. So I've been with the foundation now for 16 years, and after year 14, I stepped back and said, we need to step back and see how we can do this more strategically. So our leadership, we did a community assessment survey to see what were the greatest needs and what were the gaps in services. And surprising enough, childcare and transportation were the two issues that came up. So we formed a public policy and community education committee, and we were charged with fostering legislative and public action that will support the elimination of generational poverty. And we selected childcare, and we partnered with Georgia Budget and Policy Institute to develop a report that basically illustrates the long-term benefit to the state of Georgia if more money was directed to increase childcare subsidies. I have copies of the report on the table if you'd like to get a copy. It can also be found on our website and GBPI's website. But I just want to talk to you a little bit about what came out of those findings for that research. So based on the research that GBPI did, we felt that Georgia needs to direct more money into childcare subsidies, and those dollars should be used to increase the income eligibility threshold for childcare assistance, increase the reimbursement rates paid to childcare providers, and decrease childcare co-payments for families. There's an assumption that from many that these women don't want to work. The bottom line is they don't have childcare, and those that do have childcare, they don't have a way to get there. That has been the biggest barrier. There are some women that spend 4 hours on MARTA trying to get from work to and from work. There was a woman, one of our nonprofits that we supported, she worked at the airport. She couldn't get to work on time, so she slept there every night so that she can get to work on time. This is a reality for many. And, a lot of people say poor people, they don't want to work, they're lazy. It's a lot of work being poor. It's a lot of work being poor. So our research shows that parents who receive child care assistance experience fewer work disruptions. Work disruptions cost U.S. businesses an estimated $3 billion each year. Our research also shows that parents who receive child care assistance stay employed longer, produce higher family earnings, and helps unemployed parents find work. In the state of Georgia, approximately 5% of the children, in the state of Georgia, only 5% of children are provided child care assistance. In 2013, approximately 55,000 children were covered. That sounds like a lot, but 876,000 were not. Our research shows that child care assistance can save the government money over time. And here's an example of how. An unemployed single mother of two, ages 2 and 4, without child care assistance may receive $447 in food stamps, $176 in unemployment benefits, and $280 in cash assistance through TANF. Total monthly cost to the government without unemployment insurance is $727. The total annual cost to government with unemployment insurance is $9,384. For an average annual cost of about $3,259 per child care slot, this same single mother can be employed earning $28,000 a year, and with child care assistance, this single mother can pay about $540 in Georgia state taxes. She is less dependent on public assistance, no longer qualifies for food assistance, TANF, or unemployment insurance. The government upside in the first year would be $6,125 in savings and $540 in additional Georgia taxes. So our research clearly shows that directing more money to child care assistance in Georgia will help strengthen families and our economy.
Yeah. That's great. Thank you.
Yeah. And thanks for your work on this, Melissa. Melissa did an amazing job. I sound smart, but Melissa...
I was looking at Deshonda, like, carry the one.
Next, I wanted to have Barbara join us from North Fulton. And talk about kind of what you see as a charity organization that sees people really needing a lot of things, but in particular to highlight some of the work that y'all have done around healthcare access and what you see folks dealing with when they don't have health insurance, when they don't have an easy way to get the healthcare services they need.
Thank you, Tim. I enjoyed all the numbers and charts, but I'm glad I don't have to do that. I work with people. North Fulton Community Charities serves Fulton County north of the Chattahoochee, an area that we think of and know as a high-income area. We see 5,000 families in a year's time that need some kind of financial assistance in that high-income area. We see 100 families every day for food. It is a hidden population. Because of the high income, it is a high service area demand, and there are a lot of jobs, right? People come where there are jobs and try and live as close as they can. The schools are good. And unfortunately, the cost of housing is high. There is no very poor access to public transportation. And so it's the trifecta that we see is no health care, public transportation, and the cost of housing that is impacting all of the families we see. We in 2012 opened an education center in response to what we were seeing was people were not getting out of the hole that they were in. They had barriers that they were not able to broach. And so our education center now has 4 levels of English language. About 40% of our families don't speak English as a first language. And we do job coaching and budgeting and GED tutoring and all kinds of life skills that our families need. We're doing some certification classes to help folks get a little leg up in getting work. We host certified assisters to try and get folks covered with health care under the marketplace. And the unfortunate thing is that the working folks that we see that come for an appointment with an assister, less than a third of those who come are eligible for a government subsidy on their health insurance. Now, they can still buy health insurance on the marketplace, but at full price because they're under the wage, the gap, so they don't qualify. They were the folks who would have been covered by expanded Medicaid if Georgia had chosen to do that. I find it unconscionable that we don't find a way to cover folks with health care. It doesn't have to be Medicaid. There are other ways, expanding Medicaid, there are other ways that states have done it, but this is the biggest problem that we see for families. 60% of the families that we see are in trouble financially because of something medical. Okay? And it's like living with a guillotine over your head. It's just one health crisis away from financial ruin and disaster. And it's in the families who don't have health insurance that a crisis comes quicker because they haven't attended to the preventative things that all of us need. When we did a study, just under 60% of the families that we served did not have health, the adults did not have health insurance, whereas only 20% of the children did not have health insurance. Now, we do deal with with some population that is not eligible for, because of their immigration status, for coverage, and that probably won't change. But we can at least cover those who would be eligible if we could find a way. To just touch on the transportation piece, in North Fulton, 25% of available jobs are accessible by public transportation. 25%. The push for expanding transportation, public transportation in North Fulton is a rail all the way up to Alpharetta that will get high-income folks to the airport and downtown. It is not bus transportation that will get folks to work. And I won't fault MARTA for that. It is really our legislator, our local political leaders who are not interested, okay? It's not, they don't see that as an issue. But but at the same time, I'll give you another quick fact, at the same time, the number one number of employees in the city of Roswell are in restaurants. Okay, they're not making a lot of money. They are service industry jobs. And so the choice is, I have to live, if I can't get there, right? I have to, and less than half of the folks that we serve have a car. They get here, get to us all sorts of ways, but in expensive ways. So the choice is, do I live close to my job when I don't have transportation? So I pay an extra high fee in rent. The average rent in our community is over $900. You know, if a family's only bringing home $1,200, It's a recipe for disaster. And so we do a lot of propping folks up, trying to keep them going and encouraging them to do the barrier reducing things that are available. And just one more thing, that the talk about EITC reminds me that this is the time when we start talking with folks about, you know, you're going to get that EITC check, that chunk. What are your plans for that? Okay? What are you thinking you're going to do with that? How are you going to make that have the most impact for your year? Okay? Maybe it's paying your rent for the next 4 months so that, or a car or something else. But it's the temptation for families who do not have money when they get that wonderful big check is not to do what you and I might think was the right thing to do.
Thank you. I'm gonna kind of like Wes did, give you guys a few minutes to really think about some good questions while I kind of work back with a couple follow-ups. Barbara, obviously the simple policy response to the health coverage thing is to expand Medicaid. But in general, some of the legislative leaders, and full disclosure, I got to go up and do a conversation about this up at their facility in Roswell, and a couple of the local legislators were there, and I was in particular taken aback by the comment made by one of them, this charity organization who's on the ground trying to help people who need help is hosting a convening to talk about how we extend health coverage to more people. So kind of the implication is we can't do this all by ourselves, who basically stood up there and said, this is the role of charity. Why do we need to create this government solution? We have groups on the ground who are going to take care of it. Given that it was obvious that you guys are trying, but that there are gaps and there's only so much you can do, beyond the expansion of Medicaid, are there some things that you see from a policy response standpoint that could either help you guys fill those gaps better, or is this largely a getting people to realize that that the on-the-ground charities cannot do it all?
Well, I our local legislators want no part of expanding Medicaid or solving some of those issues. But I think there is some movement on trying to figure out, okay, what are we going to do with our hospitals who are going down the tubes? Grady is coming up with a proposal that, that will be good, and the families that we serve are can be served by Grady. I resist the idea that you have to depend on charity for health care. To me, that's immoral. And I think that the public, the clinics, community clinics that are around are wonderful and do wonderful work, but I am going to fight as hard as I can for coverage for families. To me, it should be a right just like education.
I completely agree. Thank you. Shifting gears a little bit back to this sort of how we build the skills and capacity for folks to get better jobs. Melissa, you have a report coming out that looks at a couple ways the state could kind of better take advantage of these of some of the programs that they have access to. I wonder if you could talk about a couple of the findings or a couple of the recommendations or what you learned as part of that in terms of how the state could do this
better. Sure. So like I alluded to earlier, there are two programs that we're going to talk about in the report, TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, and SNAP. And TANF is a Black grant that we get as a result of welfare reform. We get over $300 million each year. And this is money that the intent behind it was to use this money to help people get to work. What Georgia has done over the course of several years is use this pot of money, since it is a Black grant, to backfill cuts in other areas, in other human service areas. So now we have a situation where most of our TANF money is going to fund child welfare, to backfill child welfare cuts. And that is important, and we believe in the funding of child welfare, but we've got to be able to do two things at once, more than two things at once. And since the intent behind TANF is to put people to work, we think that more of that money should go to where it is intended to go. And that is the main recommendation in that piece of the report. In the SNAP education and training part of the report, if you're not familiar with the portion of the food stamp program that is supposed to be for education and training, there are millions of dollars available through the federal government each year specifically to educate and train people who are eligible for food stamps. And Georgia has just really within the last year started to take more advantage of these dollars, but we're just scratching the surface for this. And we're building out programs that are putting people in activities like job search, because it's cheap to get a program like that up and running. It takes some money and some investment to build out education and training. And I think that there's an appetite to do so, but we really need to take a look at partnering with technical colleges and great partners like we have up here on the stage that do not only education and training themselves, but provide the services and supports so that people can get training, so that people can have childcare and transportation and all those other things that we've talked about. So there is money available through the SNAP Employment and Training Program, and we just need to take some time to plan out a robust program so that we can take better advantage of these dollars that are virtually uncapped at the federal level.
Great, thank you. And Ray, you also mentioned the partnerships that you have with the technical schools. I wonder if you could, kind of building on this idea that there could be potentially some resources to help increase the capacity. Obviously, Goodwill of North Georgia would be one of those organizations that would be able to do more training and more education. I wonder if you could talk about how you're partnering with the technical schools and how potentially some more resources or more investment in this area could build capacity.
Okay. As I mentioned before, we're in the job training, job placement business, and for most of our history, and Goodwill of North Georgia has been around for 90 years now, we did a lot of internal training programs. And we were just sharing discussions we had a few minutes ago that one of our investors in our training program for women going into construction trades. So we did that some time ago. But what we found is what we're really better at is working with folks on developing the soft skills for success. And that we found our best partners would be the Technical College System of Georgia, a great system that Georgia has that many states don't invest in very appropriately. And so we can help work with the folks that we're serving, getting them into a skills training program at a technical college that might take 6 weeks or 6 months, or something that gives them the certification to go to work and hopefully get to that middle skill job, which has a more middle income range of services. So that's the opportunity that we are working on currently to do that. And the investment that we make in training folks to get to those middle skills jobs is extremely important in moving folks from the low skill, low income jobs into those middle skill jobs. My concern for the future is probably more strategic than the short-term tactical that I just described. It is what, and in part what some of Mike's data shared with that and what our observations are at Goodwill is that the number of jobs for people who have low skills, the folks that are entering the workforce that have low skills, is growing. The number of jobs that these folks can have entry into may grow in total numbers, but the opportunities are actually shrinking in proportion to the people that are entering into the workforce. That's an issue of the future that's going to be quite dramatic. The second thing that was talked about earlier as well is the middle skill jobs change dramatically and rapidly. So they're coming and going. So some of those middle skill jobs and some of the research that we were doing also were showing that in the future, those jobs are shrinking. And I was reading an article last night that the projection is over the next decade or two, 46% of those jobs will go away. They'll be changing, partly driven by technology, partly driven by changes in the environment and the marketplace. So for us, working with folks at these levels who are entering the workforce and moving into middle skill jobs, the dynamics of economic development. We haven't spent a lot of time talking about that today. Where are the jobs going to come from in the future? Who's going to attract them? What are they going to pay at? What kinds of work is that going to be? Economic development will drive the success of helping people move into middle skill jobs in the future.
Thank you. Deshonda,
yes.
You had some stats in there that kind of took me a minute to really comprehend. The fact that there were about 55,000 kids who got help,
yep.
And there's somewhere close to 900,000
yes.
who didn't. I think one of the difficult issues to tackle with the child care assistance or with child care in general is that it is both seemingly exorbitantly expensive from a parental standpoint.
Absolutely.
While also not really a high wage job from the worker standpoint.
Absolutely.
And so this weird world where, you know, somebody who is working at one of these facilities probably wouldn't be able to make enough money to actually pay to put their own
Absolutely.
Child there. And so how do we, given this is such a big barrier to surely more than just single parents getting in the workforce,
Absolutely.
but two-parent households, how do we address this kind of comprehensively? Obviously, we know we need to fund more childcare assistance, yeah. But what else should we be thinking about?
I don't
about
know. It's, you know, our focus at the Atlanta Women's Foundation are on women impacted by poverty. So we do our work through that lens. So as far as the two family households, you know, that's really not our focus. It's important to us, but it's really not our focus. I don't know, you know.
Well, then on the single parent issue, then I mean, yeah. We saw the well, growth in, yeah. in that type of family.
Well, I think it's important to, you know, as I mentioned in the research, it shows that it'll be better for the economy to increase child care subsidies. But I think we need more than that, and that's what we do at the Atlanta Women's Foundation. Prevention programming is important. So we don't just do public policy is actually kind of new for the Atlanta Women's Foundation. So, you know, we're kind of green. We're partnering with you all, and you've all have been great partners. But, you know, with grant making, that's more of our expertise. And so with the research that we did, we identified the foundational issues that were impacting women and girls in poverty, health and wellness, and life skills and education. And so we believe that girls need mentors in order to break that cycle so that the next generation of girls won't, child care subsidies won't be an issue. So we have to break the cycle now. But for the families that are in need now, we have to do something for the families that are in need right now. We understand that this is an uphill battle. You know, we have a 3-year strategy. You know, we're kind of just coming out of the gate, you know, and we're really excited about this work, but we understand it's gonna be a challenge. But and it's not just about what the government should do. We are a funder, we're a fundraiser. So we're actually out there raising dollars to also put back in the community, to fund scholarship programs for those women that have been pushed off because they had a 50-cent raise and they no longer qualify for child care subsidies. We're hoping to raise money to help subsidize those women that have been put off of the roll.
Can I throw something out?
Please.
I don't think it will happen, but it would be wonderful if we could go back to having a needs-based pre-K program.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the pre-K, you know, link to this is obviously significant, and I mentioned briefly the recommendations to boost funding for pre-K, but that certainly will not go far enough. I was talking to Claire about, you know, the levels. We're going to increase assistant pre-K teacher salaries from something like 12,000 to 14,000. It's like, well, that's a nice raise, but it would be a lot better if it was from like 27,000 to 29,000 if we really want to improve the quality and access.
For the Atlanta Women's Foundation, our focus is on kids from 0 to 3. Those are the ones that are really being left out.
Yeah. We have lots of time for questions, and I hope that there are some good ones out there. And if there's breaks, then I'll chime in with some more. We'll work this way, so I'll try to keep tabs on who wants something.
Hello, this question is for Mr. Bishop. You were talking about partnering with the technical schools for training. Low-income people can't always have the money to invest in training, and Goodwill has been training the people without that or on a sliding pay scale. How is partnering with the technical schools going to affect that and their ability to pay for this training?
Well, I think when working with the technical colleges, they have access to scholarship monies as well, so some of that's available for assistance. We also work with individuals. Almost, you know, most of the folks that we're working with that are going to go to technical colleges and get a degree are also working. So part of our mission is to help them find that job as well while they're in school that helps them balance all that out. So it's a piece of funding to help them with scholarship monies. It's a piece of funding to help with finding the job and keeping the job. And for our own employees, we help underwrite that. We have a number of programs for educational opportunities, some with the technical colleges and other institutions that we help provide scholarships for that.
I was just going to piggyback off of that or add a little bit more. The SNAP ENT funding that I was talking about, employment and training funding, that is a potential source of funding that could be used specifically for financial aid for people.
Mm-hmm. And at the same time, a broader effort at the state level to boost need-based financial aid, not just for four-year colleges, but for technical colleges as well. And we're in the middle of working on a report to kind of better highlight and examine that need.
Mr. Bishop, your comment about economic development really stuck out to me as someone who used to work in economic development.
Okay.
And so I really wondered for y'all, how has your relationship with the business community as you're trying to help find people jobs, what are you doing to kind of engage them? Because we know sometimes the business community has a different voice with legislators than the nonprofit community. So I just want to know about any partnerships or ways that you've worked with different businesses or business organizations to try to move things forward for your clients and people in poverty.
Yeah, thank you for the question. We're working with thousands of employers every year. So in Goodwill of North Georgia, we'll work with more than 6,000 different employers to put people to work in the 45 counties of North Georgia. Most of those are small and medium-sized businesses. We do work with some large employers, but most are small and medium-sized businesses where most of the job creation seems to be happening. Okay, these are employers that have 2, 12, 20, seldom do they have more than 100 or 200 employees. So those are fairly small businesses. So we work with those businesses not only one-on-one, a business, the business relationship, but also with business associations. So we have a training program at Chattahoochee Tech on floor installation, and that's being done with some of the flooring manufacturers that are located in North Georgia, as well as the trade association to do that. So when folks are finishing those training programs, they've got a job when they walk out the door. So that's part of the partnership when you work with employers who know that they need these kinds of jobs and skills in the future, and where they got to get their workforce from. And again, it goes back to not only the hard skills that are being taught, but the soft skills that are being taught. Failure rates for folks when they go in and enter and go to work generally are not because they didn't have the hard skills that might have got them the job. They might lose the job because of the soft skills issues. So yeah. It's all that goes together. But thank you for asking the question.
I was going to see if anybody else wanted to weigh in on specifically the business community relationships on any of these issues.
Hello, I'm Jasper from the Georgia Alliance to End Homelessness. I'm going to apologize if this question is a little long-winded. I couldn't figure out how to condense it. I've been working with the Georgia Alliance for about 8 or 9 years now. As I've gone to college, and the college took 8 or 9 years going half-time and working. Quite expensive. So I would like to know, being in this industry and just looking at everything that's going on, how complicated solving poverty and homelessness is. Are there any efforts being taken along the lines of any predictive analysis on the changing face of homelessness? One of the things I've noticed is by the time an issue or a population gets recognized, it's much later than they arose. So whether it's war or economic collapse or whatever the catalyst is that creates the poverty or the issue with a certain demographic, it takes a while before the government or whoever picks up on it. So being a recent graduate, I graduated, last month? last month. And on the day of my graduation, I also got a lovely little $500 bill from the student loan company letting me know it's that time. So I'm wondering, has there been any efforts in regards to predictive analysis on this, my demographic, saying, hey, there's a good risk that because of Carnathy, I believe it was? Carnathan, yeah. Mr. Carnathan, showing that this mass exodus of middle-wage jobs and income, where these college graduates like myself would normally land into, hopefully, those are gone, those are leaving. What's the likelihood that, let's say, this massive population of the $1.3 trillion of student loan debt is going to land us with another large population of homelessness in the near future?
I want to congratulate you first on your graduation. Thank you. There is a lot of data right now about how poverty is moved to the suburbs, who are not prepared to provide the services. That certainly is the case where I work. One of the things that we have are a lot of extended stay hotels who we are utilizing as homeless shelters because there's nothing in our own community for someone that does not have housing. So it's the services are slow to come to areas where the poverty is now rampant. And as far as the student loan debt, good luck.
I'll just add that the student loan debt is a huge issue. I think it's an issue coming up, especially since we know now that millennials are the largest generation. And I think it gets back to the need-based financial aid discussion, right? Because without that need-based financial aid, people are going to take out student loans, and in a lot of cases, they don't complete, so they end up, you see in a lot of the data, people with the debt and no degree, and that is one of the worst places that you can be, right? So I think it does get back to the research and the policy recommendations get back to the need-based financial aid and the need for targeted training.
And I think housing is one of the bigger issues that I will speak just for myself, but I know others at GBPI kind of lament that we don't have the time and bandwidth to kind of get into it a little bit more. And it affects so many aspects. And just from a healthcare standpoint, we've worked with Mercy Care, one of the federally qualified health centers, who serves a large homeless population, and they will tell you how much they see the link between not being able to access health coverage, not being able to get the care that people need in order to keep their jobs and keep their homes, and thus fail, you know, prevent them from ending up in that situation. But also at the same time, that in the health world in particular, hopefully we're at least nearing an evolution in the way we think about what qualifies as a healthcare service and how we think about wraparound services that affect health, and certainly housing is one of them. And you know, programs that serve people with mental illness have long looked at housing as one of those services that they need to provide in order to treat that. But it affects other health situations as well. And I think that there are some efforts underway nationally to better understand kind of how we can provide some of those services in a way to positively influence health. And so at least to bring that conversation into more policy areas as opposed to just the housing sphere, but realizing how it is connected to other things. So I'd be happy to chat with you more about that. I have one in the back.
Yes, hi, I'm Vicki Elisa with Mother's Voices. Glad you mentioned housing. Just spent on Monday 7 hours in a Clayton County court listening to over 180 eviction notifications of individuals who, as the first of the year, lost their housing. So my question really has to do with the predictive analysis and the growing trend of older single women who are outliving their retirement assets, who are now hopefully transitioning into what we hope to believe, because I'm one of those older women, a secure retirement, but the growing trend that these women are finding themselves outliving assets and having to maintain being in the workforce. Are there any trending that you're seeing on your end in terms of how to better prepare these women for jobs when you're in your 60s and 70s and you need those dollars to maintain your livelihood?
So along with
yes,
I would
you guys
say,
are tough.
I know. I would say, Taifa, get out a pencil because we're writing our policy agenda here. along with housing, and we lamenting that we don't have enough bandwidth to really talk about housing. Retirement, as you brought up, is a huge factor. We know in the data that if we look at the population 65 and over, that women are much more likely, as you said, to be poor than men in that same age bracket. So I think retirement solutions in and of themselves are their own challenges in need of policy solutions.
I'd like to challenge the assumption that needs-based funding is the solution from a policy perspective. All of us in this room share a common commitment to helping people in need. But from a policy perspective, some of the programs that last the longest are the ones that benefit everybody in a community. So as you were talking about aging, the two programs that really helped seniors with poverty were Social Security and Medicare, which are both universal programs. So for pre-K and education in Georgia, we've been successful in getting those programs because they are universal. And if we change them to needs-based funding, I fear they will disappear. So I'd like to hear a conversation about that. I don't want us to just assume that needs-based is the solution.
And I think that's a great point, Martha. And I think from the healthcare standpoint in particular, you can see differing opinions of Medicare and Medicaid as kind of some evidence of this. That said, if we look at who benefits from HOPE, it is decidedly more well off than the state of Georgia, and certainly more well off than the revenue source, if you're looking at the lottery as a revenue source. And I don't think, certainly wouldn't want GBPI's comment about needs-based financial aid to mean we think HOPE should be changed. HOPE is there, HOPE is not going anywhere, but in addition to HOPE, we also need to have need-based financial aid as well. And I completely understand and grant the risks of that in terms of sometimes need-based programs are not as robustly supported by everybody because they don't benefit everybody. But in the sphere of HOPE in particular, I think it's clear that it's leaving too many people out, and that there needs to be, a needs-based component to how we help people get access to financial aid for college. I am certainly not the pre-K expert, so I'm not going to delve into that one so much. Only to say, as a father of a four-year-old, I think it would be great if we had high-quality statewide pre-K for everybody, but it really does need to be for everybody and not a situation where it's for everybody, but really it's just the 30% at the top that have the most access to it.
Thank you all for this marvelous and intellectual and very studied service that you've offered us. I have a question that has to do with, first of all, as you are all talking, it seems like we are trying to create solutions within a body that is kind of boxed in. I would like to know, with our tax dollars, how can we get more? One of the former presenters showed a slide that said in 1984, if everything as projected would have carried on, poverty would have been eliminated. There have been a lot of things that happened that creates this energy that we have now that is expanding poverty. And there are people that have gathered together to create solutions. But as you've spoken, it's not for everyone. I would like to know, do we need more regulations? Whose job is it to end poverty? If this isn't a goal within the state, and as you said so clearly, churches cannot respond, and NGOs and organizations can do a little, but what is the broader idea that we need to have a conversation about? Whose job is it to make sure that poverty doesn't increase? And is there a role for the government that isn't less taxes? Is there a broader role for an increase of tax from the 1% that will bring more money and also recreate a middle class safety net.
So there's a lot there. I'm gonna take a stab, but I, at the same time, don't want to be the only one answering. I think, like probably a lot of you, I think the slide that David put up there about how if we had continued to distribute, if you will, the benefits of the productivity growth to all people, that poverty would have ended back in the 80s. I mean, that's amazing. So it clearly, I think, shows that the economy used to benefit people more broadly than it does now, so it can again. As for the role of the state, I mean, by any measure, Georgia is a low-revenue, low-investing state. So there's certainly a greater role for the state here. We've seen it with the conversation around childcare assistance, around what we could do if we expanded Medicaid, education. We put most of our state dollars into education, yet still we're like 37th in per pupil investment into public education. So I think that the list of areas where the state could invest more and improve the situation for a lot of people is long. How we raise the revenue to do that obviously is a complicated question in a place where standing up and saying that we should tax the 1% more will get things thrown at me in most rooms. So that's where it's difficult. I think that there's a lot of people who understand the limited resources Georgia invests and who think we should be able to invest more. Getting to that conversation about how we raise the revenue to do it is where your pool of people nodding in agreement gets a lot smaller. So I'll say one more thing and then let others answer. As to whose job it is, I mean, I think that for the most part, people are here because we think it's all of our jobs. And certainly we think it's something that we're trying to do at GBPI. I think it's obvious that each of these three panelists not at GBPI are trying to do this in their work. And so, I think that is it certainly takes more than just whomever's job it is to solve it.
I think God's sending us a message.
Got a message.
I know. Sorry, I didn't really mean tax the 1%. Sorry. Just an example. Anyway, anybody else? I mean, I think in particular, the three of you who are serving people might have some insight as to how you think about this too.
My two cents. I'm old, okay? I used to have a lot more faith that we could persuade our government to work with us and solve some of these issues that we have together. I don't see the political landscape in that respect anymore. Perhaps we can change it, but it's going to be we who change it because our current legislators have no interest.
I pretty much agree. Just in our years of doing this work, what I found is poverty is not sexy. And when you say it, people just kind of want to walk away from it. It's not my problem. There's a lot of assumptions made about people that are impacted by poverty. They caused it. It's kind of like a throwaway group of people. This side of town we don't go on. And it's just, it's all of our job. We all have to come together to address this issue. And we have to understand it. It's really about awareness and understanding this population of people.
At the risk of if there are other questions, I mean, I think that question tees up the afternoon conversation
yes.
really, really well in terms of the barriers that we face as a state, as a country, at addressing some of these issues. And I almost just kind of want to leave it there and let people go get lunch early. Unless there's some burning questions, because I do think that, especially with all the effects that we piped in for that question,
Yeah.
Special effects are good.
The special effects are amazing.
I think Tim is right on for us to do that. And I've heard some great feedback so far today about what you've heard from Mike's conversation or Mike's presentation. So I want to challenge you, as you listen, as you've taken notes, as you've tweeted, when Angela gets up here, when the panel that follows her gets up here and we talk about these issues broadly, I want you to commit to work with us moving forward, because I do think it's a collective issue. And I have always said this and will always say it. This is not something that the government can do by itself. Mm-mm. This is a collaborative effort. Just last night, is Kyle still in the room? From the community food bank, he left. We were in the room, we're having appetizers with some of the new executive directors of some of the new of the nonprofits in Georgia. And the conversation was, how do we move the state forward and how do we do it together? It seems that this collective impact is a new idea, but people have been doing this for a long, long time, working in community, sharing resources, and sharing goals and a mission to work together. So I'm committed to have this conversation, even if it's not today, but for us to come back and think about all the policy solutions that Erica shared, that David shared, the challenges and the maps that we've seen all over this state. Keep those things in your mind, because we want to work toward the solutions. Because even though it's not all government, there is a way that public policy can facilitate better opportunity. And that's where we want to bring those solutions and those ideas to bear, because there are ways that we can make the state better through our elected officials, through the communities, through philanthropy, through the business community. We can do this together. So, and with that, enjoy lunch, come back, and we'll get Angela up. Thank you.
Interesting.
You got the top one? Seriously.
God, I was like, what the? All right, they need to de-mic us.